Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, Essie Fleenor, and I'm here today with one of your other hosts.
It is I, Sarah Century. I'm so happy to be here. Also, today we have guests. That's not abnormal these days. We're an interview podcast now, but I always feel necessary to point this out. Today we have Amanda Connor and Jimmy Palmiotti. Welcome to the show, you two.
Hello.
Thank you. Woo! Thank you.
Very excited.
It sounds like somebody stepped on an owl.
I was trying to be someone who was far away cheering.
Oh, okay. All right.
I was an owl that was far away cheering.
That's it. That was an owl cheer.
Well, that's perfect. Perfect.
For
intro.
Most of our listeners, I think that, you know, you need no introduction, but please tell us about yourselves.
Hello.
The end. Well, that was great.
I'm an artist. I've been drawing since I was about 3 years old because both of my parents are artists. And I used to just, make off with their art supplies. And I'm probably best known for Harley Quinn, Power Girl, right now Red Sonja.
Marrying Me. Come on. That's like number 85.
and just doing a lot of drawing in general, I think.
And writing?
Yeah, I do writing too. I actually, Jimmy's mostly the writer. I do some writing, but I prefer drawing.
Yes, which is good. That goes to me. Jimmy, yes. Here. I started out in comics as an inker, and I inked like 1,000 comic books and got sick of it. And switched over to publishing and writing and been working on things since the mid-90s with event comics like Ash and Painkiller Jane. And then eventually to Marvel Knights with Joe Quesada, where we launched the Daredevil, Black Panther, Inhumans, and The Punisher. And saved Marvel's ass. And then I ran away and started writing other books and eventually working with Amanda a lot on things like Gargoyles and Vampirella, and eventually Power Girl and Harley Quinn and Red Sonja.
Yeah.
That should take us up to date.
Yeah. I was going to note, because very recently we had another guest who worked on a Lois Lane comic. And Amanda, I was thinking that the first time I ever saw your work was the Girl Frenzy Lois Lane comics. That's one of my favorite characters. So I just am delighted that I've been able to talk to, very recently, a bunch of people who have worked on Lois Lane.
She's a great character. Lois Lane is cool because she's like a superhero without any powers.
Like
she's so brave. You know, it's like Superman is strong and like nearly invincible. So he's not going to get hurt. But like Lois sort of throws herself into this same situation, like knowing that she doesn't have the superpowers, and she does it anyway. So she's like super brave. That's one of the things I love about her.
She's super smart.
Yeah.
That's what I like about her. She's kind of smart enough to know that it's good to have superheroes around, but she's got her own life to live.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that.
You all cannot see my face right now, but I'm smiling so big and just nodding like happily because I love that character and I've had a lot of time to sit and think about all of the reasons that I love her. And I always appreciate to meet fellow Lois Lane fans. So
it's easy to spell too. Her name's very easy to spell. I admire that too.
The four letters and four letters combo is completely unbeatable. Anybody that has a name like that, it's alliterative, all of this, unbeatable, unstoppable.
We did one of those Walmart comics, and we did a short story with Wonder Woman and Lois Lane.
What?
Yeah, that was so much fun. It was Lois was on an adventure, and then Wonder Woman had to not save her, but lend a hand kind of thing. And then we ended the story with them eating in a restaurant, right? Which I always say, every superhero comic should end with a scene where they're eating in a restaurant afterwards. But that was kind of fun to write because what kind of conversations would those two have? And that was the fun of that story for me, at least.
Yeah.
They almost never get a team up, and they're so good when they team up. I remember Phil Jimenez did that one issue that has the two of them, and I was obsessed. It was such a good issue. But yeah, they barely get to team up. Now I'm going to like track down this backup story.
I think they put it into a collection, a Wonder Woman collection, like recently. Like they put all the short stories into one book.
Are you going to go hunt for it now?
I'm looking at it as we're talking because I think it's around somewhere. But if you look
this
up
is information, I need.
If you look up Amanda Connor and Wonder Woman in the latest trades, I think it came out within the past 6 or 8 months. So
okay, awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. Where, I don't know where it is. It's somewhere.
I remember doing the covers for it, but I don't remember co-writing it.
Well, it has a cover. It has a cover with, maybe it didn't correct, maybe I wrote it, but it all passes through you anyway. It has a cover of Wonder Woman running with a ton of animals behind her out of a fire.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the cover of the book.
I know that cover. Yeah, definitely. I think I might actually already own this comic.
Yeah, because when we got those Wonder Woman short stories, we were just like, okay, what's the power, you know, Wonder Woman doesn't really use too much? And talking with animals was the one we focused on.
Yeah.
So it has a lot of animal chat.
I think that's the Come Back to Me. I don't think that's the Lois Lane.
Oh, is that the Come Back to Me book? Maybe. Yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe they
Come Back to Me, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe that's not the short stories. I thought they put them all in one book.
Oh, maybe they might even reuse the cover.
Yeah, we have no idea what we're talking about. Okay. Don't listen to us, folks.
It's really hard to keep up.
No, it's hard to we just work and then we figure everyone else has to sort it out. So.
Yeah, fair. I have a similar method of working where sometimes I'll look back at something from like 5 years ago and be like, oh, this is good. I did a great job, but I don't remember it. Like, who is this person writing this? I have no idea.
That's how we feel on Harley because we work so much on it. Like once in a while we look back and go, oh, that's pretty insane. Like, why did that get in there? And then we remember, oh, because something in real life triggered that. But we're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I know one of the what's coming out currently, at least one of them is Invincible Red Sonja, which of course we love Red Sonja. Sarah got me up on Red Sonja, and ever since I've been like, I would die for this fellow redhead because, you know, redheads are the best part of comics, as I like to say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I read an interview where you talked about how when you were writing this run, you really wanted to go back to everything that made you first love Red Sonja. And I thought that was really interesting because you were like, oh, pirates and princesses and big battles and cutting people's heads off. All things that are very fun, especially in this run. They're just delightful. But you also paired it with like this pretty like weighty invincibility, right? Like you think invincible and you're like, hee-hee, this will be fun. And it's like, oh no, this is a horrible, horrible curse. And I'm curious, like, what was it that you wanted to get to with those, that playfulness, then, you know, sort of that underbelly of like, oh dang, it would be terrible not to die.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we kind of just wanted to address, you know, you do when you think, oh, you know, if I could live forever, that would be great. But You know, we were just thinking of the bad sides of it. You know, the downsides of living forever.
Yeah, Sonja didn't have a chance to really explore the good side of it.
Right.
You know, because when she gets these powers, so to speak, she finds out in a bad spot, you know, because she's not dying from the battle she's in. And it's not like she's using it in any way. It's just like something that's happening to her, and she doesn't know when it's going to leave her or not, because it's based on a wizard that put a spell on her. So it wasn't like a what if I was invincible story. It was more like, oh, this happens to me. I guess at some point, either I'm going to stay like this or it's going to wear off. And in the story, well, without ruining anything, but if you've been buying the book, eventually the curse kind of goes with the wizard that cast it. So she gets to use it one final time, which is when she's covered with magma. So, I avoided saying Mr. Powers, magma, Mr. Powers. So part of it was we wanted to have something above the title to make it stand out from the other Red Sonja books, a title above the title. I actually wanted our names above the title, but
Amanda and Jimmy's.
Or Connor and Pomiati's, but Dynamite was not down for that. So I wanted it to stand out from the other titles. So I was looking for something initially that would make it stand out. And at the same time, even though that's an element, it's not really what the story's about. It's just one part of the story. So, and it's a very complicated, crazy story, but you're 100% correct. It was our wish list of crazy things we wanted to happen with Red Sonja. Mm-hmm. Everything from all the sex stuff to the violence to the other characters. And again, giving her a couple of supporting characters for a run, because I think it's very important. We get to know somebody through the friends of somebody in a different way, you know. But it definitely was a checklist for us of everything we ever wanted to do with Red Sonja. And I mean, we still have a couple of issues to come out. And boy, we hit a lot of them on a checklist in the last two issues.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't wait. I'm very excited. Yeah, it feels like watching people who just love this character mm-hmm. have a fucking blast. And that comes through so clear. I was like just so engrossed. I didn't know where I was anymore. I was like, I'm on this battlefield with Red Sonja cutting off this guy's head. It was just so transporting. It was really delightful.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, Moritat, the artist, he's really funny because, you know, he's going to draw the way he draws. And he just draws her naked through the book. And we have to, like, put things in front of her parts sometimes.
Like when she's breaking out of the magma.
Oh, yeah. And there's like a nipple-sized rock in front of her, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a crotch-sized element blocking her.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, you know, it's like, of course, you know, the lava had burned all of her, you know, her armor off, but she's invincible.
But her hair comes back real quick.
Well, that's part of her body.
No, I get it. It's like, you know, we were laughing at that.
Yeah, and you know, we thought he would Austin Powers it, and you know, put things, you know, strategically in front of the things that the comics code won't allow you to show. And he didn't.
Nope. We actually ran into this a lot in Harley Quinn, which is another story. But we managed to move some word balloons around and some sound effects. But, you know, perfect world, we wouldn't have to do that, right? Because it's just the human body who gives a shit. But
right.
But yeah. But I think because it's a license, they kind of have to do that, you know? It drives me crazy because I grew up with heavy metal, reading heavy metal magazines. Yeah. So, and plus you're an artist, you go to art school and there's nude models. It's just not a big deal. Somebody's head getting cut off was a big deal to me and still is, but for some reason that's perfectly okay. So, you know, nipple versus severed head. I don't know, man, you know?
Yeah, that I think we can all agree on. It is wild. But I was also thinking, too, that this is a really sexy comic. So it mm-hmm. kind of works in a lot of ways. Sonja's just a hot character. She's out here living her life.
Yeah.
To the fullest.
I definitely discovered her when I was close to puberty. And I remember, like, being a huge Wonder Woman fan. And then when I mm-hmm. discovered Red Sonja, I'm like, wait a minute. I want to be her instead. You know? And, you know, like this badass, you know, flame-haired barbarian woman swinging a, you know, giant sword with a tin bikini. I'm like, yeah, I want to do that.
I remember the first appearance of her when she was in Conan. I think it was 23. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she jumps in that little pool of water and then she takes the top off and Conan's like, dah, you know, his like jaw hits the ground. And I just remember, like, that was like the sexiest thing I've ever seen in a regular comic book.
And how old were you then?
Old enough to appreciate it. And and I was like, oh, yeah, like, it's good to be a barbarian, I guess. Well, that's a T-shirt I wear all the time. But, like, you know, again, when we got the gig, we were like, well, let's go back to the stuff that we like. And I said, you know, I read a lot of the other Sonjas, you know, just to see what everybody else was doing. Everything from Gales to, you know, all the other series. And I'm like saying, okay, everybody brings in what they want to get across. And some people being very political or trying to update what Sonja's agenda is. And I just started laughing. I'm like, she lives day to day. And part of her day, she has like three or four needs. She has, you know, it's not like she sits around and says, I'm going to sew. you know, or I'm going to do something. I'm going to make something. Like, that's not who Sonya is, right?
Yeah, she's, I don't think she really thinks about what she needs in the future other than probably trying to, like, get her hands on some, you know, gold or jewels. Otherwise, it's just like, you know, like, I need a bath, or I need some food.
I also see her as an explorer. Like, she's constantly wants to know what's out there in the world. That's why she's constantly moving. And she doesn't want to be settled down too on some level, you know, she just wants to enjoy everything in the world she can enjoy. And when she runs out of money, let me go and, you know, either go work for hire or steal something so I can have some more fun. And, I always loved that about the character, but at the same time when we were writing her, we were like, okay, but we can put in some of the, mystical stuff and we can, you know, we had the checklist, right? There was magic, there was dragons, there was volcanoes. There was towns that were disgustingly dirty and filthy. There was a chase on rooftops. We checked that one off right away. And then there was, the list was ridiculous and it was on a piece of paper.
Do you still have it?
No, because I think we finished writing
it. You're like, so, we did it.
Yeah, we did it. I mean, there was nothing.
I bet we have it. We just don't know where it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was like, you know. Of course, we wanted to have a bar fight, you know, that had to be in there, right? So it's like on a checklist. There was a scene where a horse, you know, a thing with a horse, and we just kept adding some stuff. And I said, the last two issues have a lot of anything I didn't get to and Amanda didn't get to is in the last two issues, and we cleverly worked them all in. But we just had a blast on this thing. And, you know, we know it's not the deepest story, but there's a lot of little things going on in it. And, and also, we have like a dark sense of humor. Like when one of our bad guys gets hit by a piece of molten rock, you know, the characters are laughing because
it's so funny.
Because it is. It's so stupid.
He's mid speech, right? He's like, "I will destroy." <Yeah. laughs>
Because that's how life is, right? You don't get to do your speeches all the time, you know. People don't get hit by a car and then have a speech before they die. You know, they sometimes go, that's it. You know, so, but anyway, I'm glad you guys enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was so good. I had a lot of fun reading through this one. I think that I am a big fan of so many of the Red Sonja stories. Whenever I was a little kid, was reading a bunch of Red Sonja comics because they just were in stacks with all of the Conan and Thor comics that, you know, whatever relative had. And I just have always remembered her. She never is far from my mind. I will like think about Red Sonja and be like, I hope that her comics are doing good right now. There has been a lot of recent like team ups with her and Vamprilla that I've been really fond of. The old Roy Thomas era, Red Sonja, a lot of that stuff is just golden.
That's what we were sort of, we were trying to unleash our inner Roy Thomas and, and like, I would hope that Frank Thorne would look at it and be proud.
Yes, that's true. That's true. The crossovers are always weird to me, right? Because you really have to hyper think about it. You know, to make it work for me.
If it right, Vamprilla meets Red Sonja, and they're like, "Well, okay, time travel,"
and then they go meet Betty and Veronica.
Amazing,
hysterical. The whole thing is so funny because then they like, and then Red Sonja is like a football player in high school. You know what? I don't need it to make sense. It's perfect.
That's it.
Yeah, you know, and there's like so many ways it can be made to work. I'm like one of those people who loves a challenge. It's like, oh, you mean I have to solve this puzzle? Okay, sure.
It's funny because Dynamite's like, after issue 10, they're like, so will you do some more? And I said, no, the story ends there. And they're like, okay, but you don't want to like do the next adventure? I'm like, no, it ends there. And until next time, or we get paid more money, we're not going to do another one for a while, you know? But we definitely had said everything we wanted to say about Sonja because we look at it as this might be the only time we ever get to write her. Yeah. So we have to go in and just do everything we want. You know, if we do it in the future, great. But my thing is, you know, you can't think that way. You have to think this has to be the best we can give people. And that was our attitude with the story.
It's 10 issues total. Is that correct?
Yes. It was supposed to be 6, but we kept going crazy.
Like, oh, the list, it has not been fulfilled yet.
No, but it has. You'll You'll see. The last issue, you'll see. You'll start laughing at some of the things that go on there.
Yeah, I think this series is the best. But I was also wondering, too, because I believe they a long, long time ago, but then also more recently, you've done some Vamprella work as well. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, not writing so much. We wrote one little story here and a couple of things, but nothing that ever, I mean, there was a lot of editorial kind of weight on those. Amanda drew a lot more, and Amanda and I both worked on the art a lot. We worked with Warren Ellis and Grant Morrison and Mark Millar on a bunch of books. We did a short story where Vampirella ate a little creature,
a little demon
that consumed a large amount of laxatives, and then she had to basically shit out the demon.
So much trouble for that story.
Yeah.
But it was fun. I mean, I wanted to do something silly. You know, I was like, I had been doing, you know, the both of us, we had been doing, you know, like, they wanted to see, like, Vampirella as this, like, miserable, tortured soul. And I'm like, well, what does she do on her downtime? Oh, go to Key West during Halloween. And, you know, it's like...
The issue I have with Vampirella is I have no idea who that character is. I mean, I understand what everybody wants to do when they get on the book, but unlike Power Girl, unlike Harley, unlike whatever, I don't know who she is. Even though I've worked on the character, so, and I haven't written the character very much, so I've worked just on the books, but I've never felt I would know who the person was on Vampirella. I've never gotten an opportunity to write Vampirella as a person, so I've never made the connection past the visual on the character. There was some fun parts of it. But I understood the alien woman that comes from a blood planet much more than what they did in the books, because in the books it seemed like they just changed her every time.
They do change her a lot. I was going to say, too, I think we had Tom Sniegoski on the pod, and it was, we talked a little bit. I think about one of the issues that you drew, and then also, we were just kind of talking about how kind of the good and the bad of Vamprella is that every person has a totally different take on her. You read through and it's like, if you're super just like, you know what, whatever it is, I'm just going to read it, you know, like with Vamprella, then you can have a lot of fun with her. But then I understand what you mean, because it is a character who over time, really, it seems like the story is more like central than the character is a lot of the time. So, but I do still love Vamprella. So,
yes. Yeah, and we love Chris and Tom were great on the book.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I love really Tom's good. Accent, by the way. This is a guy from Brooklyn accent saying he loves the Boston accent and Tom.
Yeah. That Boston, it was good. Love that interview.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny when they gave us Power Girl, you know, we had like a couple of questions out of the gate. Like, where does she live? You know, what does she do? And, you know, they didn't even know how to answer them. And I think that's the same thing with Vampirella, was like, where does she live? What does she do? You know, what does she want? Right. What does she fear? And I never got a steady take on that. So for me, the character never gelled 100%, because I just feel like I still can't say, like, who did the year one, Dark Knight year one type version of Vampirella? And I don't feel I've seen that yet, if that makes any sense.
It does. And I was going to say that whereas Sonya has had a couple of year ones at this point, I think. So that's a character that I think is certainly easier to keep clear as far as what her personality is, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and bring us to my favorite topic for today, Harley Quinn. So obviously you have had many iconic runs on her, and you started to say this at the beginning of the episode. So I'm going to jump back in and dig in there a little bit. But, you know, I'm constantly surprised. Like, I will be like, oh, I have read all of the Connor Palmiotti Harley Quinn, trust me. And then my partner will go and buy me some random floppies, and I discover something like Harley Quinn and the Skull Bags, which I'm like, I didn't even know was a title, which, oh my God, so fun. And so I'm curious for you, because, yeah, you have written so freaking much Harley. are there runs that stand out for you in your mind? Does she like live in your head and you like just pop in on her for stories? Or like, what's your relationship to her? You've made her so iconic and so your own. And it feels to me like such definitive runs. I want to know, what's your deal with Harley?
You described it really. I never thought about it before, but I think you described it really well. Is she sort of lives in our head. And every once in a while, like something will happen and we'll be like, oh, that's such a Harley moment, you know? And oh, I wish we could do that in a Harley book.
Right.
But,
Well, also, I see that all the issues we did, I think it was 117 or 25 or some crazy number we did. I kind of see it as one linear story. And I know people go, but when is she with the Suicide Squad? And I'm like, this is the day after.
Yeah.
She's done with that Suicide Squad. It literally is. Our story begins the day after because she has that thing in her neck.
Yeah, I mean, our idea was that, you know, she's got the bomb in her neck. Amanda Waller tried to use it on her and it malfunctioned.
And that's it.
She's like,
later for you.
She's like, oh, I don't have to stick around for this.
So I see it as one big story. And even the last series we did, the Harley Quinn and the Birds of Prey, it still started from the last issue we did. And then we did a couple of shorts that actually continued. They actually start the next day. Even when Rebirth happened, you got to remember the issue before Rebirth. Rebirth was the only DC comic that didn't have a new story. We literally just continued our last story into it because DC said, you know what? You guys know what you're doing. You don't have to change the book. But it started at Rebirth number one. Mm-hmm. But it literally was the story the next day. And so I've always seen it as a very linear book, even with the like the miniseries with Power Girl or the miniseries with the little black book with the separate adventures. I've always seen it as a very linear thing, which might startle some people.
Yeah,
I love that. I mean, I feel like I just got such an inside scoop. I'm like, oh my God,
it is.
That's so exciting.
You're the first people we told this to.
I'm so honored.
Yes. And
that was another time where we encountered somebody who just was like averse to drawing clothing was when we did when we did the Harley Little Black Book with Lobo.
Oh, Simon Bisley, yeah.
He's just like, nah, I don't feel like drawing clothes.
She was naked in all the pages that came in.
So was he.
So was Lobo, yeah. And that boy's healthy and he's horse-like. He's horse.
That's where that term comes from. Healthy as a horse.
He's healthy as a horse. Really,
but it's so funny because I was like, oh, how are we going to do this? And we were just like, are we going to like cover all the art with word balloons? And then we came up with this idea like, you know, DC is going to red flag this. And I'm like, wait a minute. Let's just like draw little red flags to put, you know, that are like hiding all of the naughty bits. Entire issue is like red flags.
We saw Simon 2 weeks ago. He's like, oh man. And goes, I knew you guys would figure a way to cover all that stuff up. And I'm like, okay, but you could have helped us by putting our pants on at some point, you know? But that said, the pages.
Yeah, they were gorgeous.
I mean, they literally can make a fortune publishing that book without everything covered. You know, and it will definitely be. If you thought the Batawang was a big deal, wait until you see this book, you know?
Well, when you were talking earlier about nudity in comics, it reminded me of a conversation we had with Nalo Hopkinson, where she was talking about her House of Whispers run. And she was like, listen, I think nudity's fine. I just want equal opportunity nudity. And she was trying so hard to get a phallus in her books. And they were just like, no. And so she made everyone as naked as possible. And so they ended up being like ghost people. But, you know, like the ghost part started really low on their body.
I mean, even the Little Mermaid poster got some phallic things in, you know? I mean, why not?
Yeah.
I would love to do a Harley series. And that's probably the way they can get us back. If they say, totally do whatever you want. I mean, they promised that with the Black Book, but they didn't deliver that.
Yeah.
They censored a lot of it. And a lot of our language and a lot of the things, a lot of our story got sent to.
Actually, the only part that we were sort of able to go a little crazy with was the language.
Right.
And we thought, as far as physical humor and story goes, we actually were able to have a lot more leeway in the regular series than we were in the Black Book, which was weird. You know, it's like we were able to do less in the Little Black Book than we were in the original series. And I think, you know, it's like DC had changed hands.
Yeah, the Black Label you're talking about.
Right.
What? Yeah, you said that we did more in the Little Black, I mean, less in the Little Black Book.
We did. No.
We were doing more in the Little Black Book, less in the Black Label.
Oh, the Black Label. Yeah.
That's what we do all day. We clear each other's.
Yeah, we're like, oh yeah, that thing.
It was really cute. I really liked it.
Yes, we actually were able to get away with more in the Little Black Book and the regular series than we were able to in the Black Label. You know, we were allowed to swear and stuff in the Black Label, but, you know, like some of the subject matter, they were like, no, and you can't use this character. And
can't put Batman in a Speedo. We were told that the fight between Joker and Harley was too brutal.
Yeah.
And that we had to tone it down.
Yeah, it was so we started calling it the Beige Label. And but no, I mean, it was good. It was really fun and we enjoyed the story, but there was a lot of, I mean, I think it drove our editor Chris just as nuts as it drove us. You know, because he's got, you know, corporate breathing down his neck. So, I mean, it was, yeah, there was a lot more changes going on because it's like, nope, can't do that. No, can't do that. It's like, oh, it's a Black Label book. But,
come on.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have that collection, just it's literally within eyesight of me right now. The trade paperback that they just released that they did tabloid size, like all of the issues of the comic were. I am a huge fan of tabloid size comics. It's my favorite thing in the world. I like love Love and Rockets, like all of the big comics, the Treasury editions, everything.
It's fun to work on too.
Yeah, I was gonna say, because it's like you have more space almost, right? Because even though the panels, I'm sure from the page, are still being shrunk, there is still like a bigger page,
right? It is a little bit more freeing. Yeah, there was more room. It was, you know, because regular comics are a little bit, you know, thin and tall. And, you know, yeah, that size, it's like there's more elbow room.
Yeah. And I think used to good effect, because it feels like you all kind of got to go a little nuts on the backgrounds in that one. I felt like it was just so established. And not to say that any other time it's not, because I think that one really good thing about Harley Quinn, pretty much across creators, is that you always have a good background for where she's at.
Yes.
It seems like they always choose artists that are good at that. But I was going to say that in this collection specifically, I think that the environments had enough space to really become a part of the story. And I loved that about it. I thought it was really neat.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You reminded me of the very first question that you asked about it was, what is like a part of Harley that stands out in your mind? And I think for me personally, it was probably... Well, of course, like the issues where, you know, when she and Ivy go to the little island where there's the senior citizens nudist colony, because it's like such a, the book is so funny, but it's got like some really tender Harley and Ivy moments in it, you know,
yep,
and it explains a lot. Yeah. But for me personally, I'm going to say it was Be Careful What You Wish For, because I got to draw the whole thing, you know, and I don't always get to draw it, you know, and I love doing that. And it was just so funny to just be absolutely silly for like a full book, you know, and I find that like my sort of default self is like slapstick and silly. So that particular one stood out for me.
It checks all of the boxes for Harley Quinn, right? Because it has, you know, the big group. She's always working with a team, which is something that I think is really fun about that character, too, is she's always finding her people.
Yeah.
And then there is the fact that they does have those beautiful moments with Ivy, which I'm sure that both Essie and I are just dying to get into talking about those two characters, because they're our favorites. We both really, really love them. And also,
also the version of those two interacting together that you two write, like, that is the best version for me. There, I mean, at this point, there might be like some contenders that are pretty strong, but for me, this was like the first time that their relationship really did click for me. Not in this specific comic, in your Harley Quinn run, though, where you see them really being able to communicate with each other and have this bond that to me just was like, oh, this is so much healthier than what their past relationships were. Because I think that there's a lot of times when people think of these two characters specifically and they look at what their past relationships are and how unhealthy they were, and they're like, oh, they're just repeating that with each other. And in your run, I think that it's so important that that's not what's happening. I think that they are both really good at giving each other space, and also that they are still very much themselves in this book. It's not like they suddenly have no bite to them or something, right? So, yeah, I was just curious if you had some thoughts about that, because I can gush about it truly forever, because it's really one of my favorite relationships in comics.
Yeah, I mean, I think, what were you going to say, Jimmy?
I was just going to say, when writing that with Amanda, we definitely had, and this might be dating myself, this moonlighting thing where we never wanted the couple to be totally just a couple. Mm-hmm. We wanted to show how their lives were different. And when they were able to get together, it was like a gift. but it was never about, the comic was, the whole series for us was about defining who Harley is through her friends and supporting cast. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why we took her out of Gotham. That's why we gave her all the crew in Coney Island. And we didn't want her to be a secondary character in the Batman universe, which is, you know, that's their go-to all the time, right? The minute we got off the book, she went right back to Gotham and became, you know, the Harley Quinn in the Batman universe again. We wanted to do something completely different with this. And when we brought Harley in, you know, we were inspired, obviously, by what Paul and Bruce did on the series. Mm-hmm. And part of that charm was that, you know, they were kind of a little at odds with each other, and then their timing was always a little off. But you can see that Ivy had, like, sort of felt like the big sister at some point, you know, to Harley in the Bruce Timm stuff, you know, and the relationship.
Well, she's definitely the more mature character.
Yeah. And
for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, so with the relationship stuff, we were like, you know, besides the fact that DC was telling us all the time, you can't do that. We had a lot of that where they don't have that now with the books. We had it where we could only go so far. I mean, and it was us being kind of like a-holes a little bit when we decided to make a whole issue in a senior's nudist colony with them, because we were like, all right, I'm going to just see how far we can go with this and see what they start picking on. And so with the relationship, we just, again, we were afraid, I don't want to make this a Harley Ivy comic either. You know, it's got to be about Harley's life, how she's trying to process everything around her. And again, you know, multiple personalities, multiple relationships, two jobs, roller derby, working in the seniors' home. She's at the burlesque helping Tony. You know, we wanted to keep the character in a bit of chaos with her personal life. And so at least when the Ivy moments happened, they were always special. It wasn't like, oh, what are they going to do this issue? For us, it was more like, okay, she's back in her, you know, corner of the universe. You know, Ivy's in Coney Island, or Ivy's there.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we wanted to always keep it special.
Well, also, we thought it was also really important to define the relationship that Harley and Ivy had together, which, you know, it's like, you know, you would love to, you know, like in a perfect world, if you are those two characters, the world becomes perfect, and then they can spend the rest of their lives together, but that doesn't make for very exciting stories. Mm-hmm. But I'm always like, okay, Ivy adores Harley, but Ivy's first love is saving the environment and mm-hmm. the things that she has to do to stop the world from getting destroyed. You know, and settling down would just take away from all that, you know. So I think that Ivy loves to, you know, steal her moments with Harley, and you know, it's just, it's so wonderful. It's like a wonderful feeling when they're together, but then Ivy realizes that the world's not perfect yet and she has work to do. So she can't like get lost in the Harley, you know, the world of having fun with Harley. You know, she's got a job to do. And I think that's also why Harley doesn't, Ivy doesn't have jealousy when, you know, and Harley herself, Harley's in love with love. Like, she just falls in love at the drop of a hat. You know, she just is like,
look and at big me. Ladies.
Right? Yeah, she's just like, it's like, I'm in love with this, you know, I look at that person. I'm in love with them now, you know. She's just, you know, she's in love with the feeling. She's in love with this excitement. So, you know, in my brain, Ivy just sort of allows Harley to have that, you know, mm-hmm. and knowing that Harley will always be, you know, her number one, and she'll always be Harley's number one. But she allows Harley to go and, like, you know, have crushes on the whole world.
That's what's the best about it, because I'm obsessed with work. That's the way that people should be allowed to be in comics. And I think in all fiction, where you see a lot of times people are so obsessed, as you say, kind of, about how people really expect to have this team up or this couple all of the time. And I think that sometimes that can be good for characters. Like, I think that, you know, Peter Parker and Mary Jane is a team up where it's like, I just want to read those two together all of the time. But then there's times where it can be restrictive as well. So I think that it wouldn't have worked, you know, like from a story angle perspective, there was like that issue where Harley is trying to get Ivy to move in, and Ivy's like, hey, I'm going to set some boundaries, actually. Like, and that's beautiful. And to me, also something that indicates a lot of how a lot of queer relationships are, how a lot of relationships in general are, but how there has to be these kind of parameters that you're setting forward with any person that you know, really. I mean, I say all the time, like, friendships have to have boundaries, right? I just think that there's all of this that went into that relationship, so that it was like, yeah, even if I only see Ivy in this book every 9 issues or something, you know, whatever. To me, it was good anyway, because it was still one of my favorite versions of Ivy. I think also this version of Ivy has helped a lot, because there's been a lot of versions that have been kind of been turning her towards more of a complicated status, right? Like, not just a villain status for a long time. But I think that this is one where it really worked. So I always, and like how it's kind of pushed forward what they do with Ivy, you know, even today, I think that she continues to progress. But it really, this wasn't like necessarily the book for it to be an Ivy and Harley team up, even though it's great when it does happen, as you right. say.
Yeah, it is. And also it makes it more exciting when it does happen. It's like Christmas, you know, it's like it doesn't happen that often. And then when it happens, it's special. Really exciting.
Yeah, I remember on Twitter, there was a Poison Ivy group, like they love Poison Ivy, and they would not like me. You know, they would read it. We don't like this Ivy, and, you know, we don't like what you're doing with her in the book. And they were very vocal about hating what we were doing. And then when we were off the book and the book kept going, I got a nice letter from them saying, you know, we didn't know what we were talking about. Now that we're looking back on it, we think you guys had the best grasp on the character. We didn't know how to process it, I guess, at the time. It was a very nice letter, but I was like, well, that was a lot of wasted time of them hating what we were doing. But, you know, again, some people love the characters for different things. And then, you know, they any kind of change they get upset at without processing it. But all we were trying to do was always define who Harley was. And you know, their relationship definitely defined how much love Harley had to give with her pets, you know, and with her friends. And even Red Tool, who would drive her insane, she kind of has this relationship with that is not normal, but it is, you know, but it is fun to watch, because it's something, you know, I think we were laughing because we were watching that Peacemaker show, and Vigilante like reminds us of Red Tool. Yeah, we were laughing out loud. I'm like, look, they made Vigilante into Red Tool, you know, and then I wasn't the only one. Somebody did a whole article about, oh, yeah, Red Tool, your vigilante is Red Tool. And I was just like, oh, okay. But, you know, it was fun to write them too because, look, I love writing them. And I also love writing Harley and Power Girl. A different relationship, yeah. Obviously.
Because they are so opposite.
Yeah.
We've talked about this on this podcast before.
I love Harley Quinn and Power Girl so much because
the
thing that I personally love about your Harley is she is always ready to shoot her shot. Like, she doesn't care what scenario it is. Like, I think at one point she is falling off of a building and Power Girl's like about to save her and she's like, or we could make out. And Power Girl is like, God damn it, Harley.
What's wrong with you?
And I'm like, Harley! You know, it's just so... And that's why I thought The Little Black Book was so charming, because it was like, yes, we know she's doing these things. You had implied it, you know. We had seen between the lines. We could see, like, okay, she's kind of like either banging or trying to bang everybody. Right. And again, I have mad respect for that. I just love it so much. And I think it's just so funny. I think anytime two characters swap clothing, it's just really, really gay. And so when, like, there's a point where she and Power Girl are in each other's clothes and she and Wonder Woman are in each other's clothes. And you are the masters of nailing that moment and it being both like sexy and just so, so funny.
And the secret, I love it so the secret much. Weapon,
thank you.
It's Amanda's secret weapon. I said Amanda's artwork is to that kind of stuff is what Betty Page is to sexy photos.
Yes. If you like the pod, you like our general vibe, you want to see us eat meals, survive, thrive in the world, come back with the podcast, be cool all the time, make money, get cars. I don't know. At that point, I was just buy new shoes, get a pony, invest in Bitcoin.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and argue with that last one. But otherwise, I am there with you.
Okay, I'm not going to invest in Bitcoin. But hey, if you want to see us, you know, be financially soluble, please join us on Patreon at patreon.com/bitchesoncomics. We have tons of content there. We have, I think it's like 100 back episodes. So those are things that range from talking about individual independent comics that we like, as, you know, each of us on our own together, to talking about Wynonna Earp, why we loved it so much. Yes, we had a bonus episode about it before we had a mainstream episode about it. Who could say why? Why not? We have our cage match episodes, which are just so wild. We just compare two Nicolas Cage films and then decide which is cagier. And it's probably the highlight of my life, if I'm being honest. We also have our Intoxicated Comics special that we do where we get a little bit woohoo and then talk about weird comics. Sometimes we have a great time and sometimes we're like, what have we done? And either way, it's pretty funny. We also have exclusive interviews with smaller creators, all kinds of different stuff. We basically use our Patreon as an opportunity to put more good comics info out there. Oh my goodness, a very pretty bird just landed outside my window.
Oh, in this spot, we got to talk about this bird. All right, let's get through it.
This bird has a little red head. Oh, it flew away. Beautiful little bird. Thank you, bird. So yeah, you know, come join us on Patreon so I can look at more birds. We're at patreon.com/bitchesoncomics. You got to spell it out. You can't go to patreon.com and then search us because we're, I don't know,
bitches.
We curse too much. We're some they're like, you sound like some real bitches. So we're not going to make you searchable. And we were like, fair.
Fair.
Harsh, but fair.
Yeah,
harsh,
I deserve that. Fair. I deserve it.
And that's like exactly my next question. So I'm so glad you said that, Jimmy, which is like, it is this fine line, right, of portraying sexy women and not, and I've been struggling with like what the not is, right? Like not objectifying, but like some objectification's fun, you know, not being like gross, but some kind of grossness is fun. So I'm just curious, how do you find that line and also be like so fucking hot and so fucking funny?
Like, how do you manage that?
I you know what it is? It's as simple as this. It's like, there is nothing wrong with super sexy and you know, like super ultra hot and everything. But in my head, it has to have personality. You know, there has to be like a human behind it. You know, it's like, and I see a lot of times, you know, people will do hot and sexy and it'll just be, you know, like I think a perfect example is of this is like the characters of the 90s where all the men had like giant bulging veiny muscles and Clint Eastwood grimaces.
Yeah.
And all of the women had like wasp waists and model pouts. And that was it. You know, and it didn't go beyond that. And I'm like, you know, sexy is great. And who is the person behind all of this sexy? You know, it's like, I feel like it's really important to put a person behind the sexy or a personality behind the sexy.
Yeah. I mean, I've been writing women forever in comics, you know, with Bankula Jane.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
With Trigger Girl and then mm-hmm. with Power Girl. We, you know, Justin and I wrote Power Girl for Amanda. And I've been, and I think, you know, somebody asked me, it's like, you know, you get away with a lot more than other people do in comics and you don't get shit for it, you know? And I always said, well, because we have a story, number one. Number two, it's like we're defining who the character is. And I said, their sexuality is part of them. It's not what the story is about. It's just a part who they are. It's the part of them. And I do, I like that. I remember why I bought comics when I was a kid and I kind of apply it, you know, I kind of apply it and say, look, I like it because it's this risk taking. It's things are risky. Things are a little, you should try to push the envelope a little bit. And, you know, with Harley, we always in the book, I mean, look, when we took on Power Girl, we wrote a whole scene where she's running naked with groceries and they're falling down. And, you know, but I also knew my secret weapon was a man that was drawing it. And it was going to come off sweet and cute and funny and sexy at the same time. I think Amanda's art, again, Betty Page's it a little bit. Says, people can see the wink of the eye and understand the, you know, it's not jazz playing sexy. You know, it's not like that jazz is a saxophone is going to start playing in Amanda's scenes. You know, it's a different.
Not that it can't,
but it's not that.
Not that it can.
It's always a little playful and it's sweet and it's sexy. And even with Harley and Ivy, you know, there's a playfulness about them. You know, even when Harley would drive Ivy crazy, there always was a point where Ivy would smile and give in and say, you know, you're insane, but come over here, get over here. And even with Painkiller Jane, when I write Jane, it's whole scenes where she's completely naked having a conversation with her girlfriend and she's in the shower and they're talking completely naked. And yes, I understand who reads the book, but at the same time, that is also what I've witnessed in my life when right. women do when in a hotel room, they talk through their bath. They sit on the toilet and talk to each other.
That's true. We do.
You know, and so I've always thought, well, if I can just reflect that a little bit in the book and, you know, I'll piss off somebody. Of course, that's what we do for a living. We piss off people here and there. I mean, it's okay. It's okay, though. It's okay. It's okay. Right. Because it causes conversation. And that's okay. But I think the secret weapon for me has always been I have Amanda, because when we both wrote Harley, if people didn't like parts of the books, they would blame me for it. And when they love parts of the book, they're like, Amanda Connor really knocked it out of the park in this issue. Right?
I'm sorry, babe.
No, it's okay. You know, but there were whole things where Palmiotti really destroys the blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, okay. They never want to admit that both of us wrote it. And they just choose sides, and I'm okay with that. But I've always had a insane respect for women, and I've always had strong women in my life. And I got to think that comes across in the work I work on.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't really know any weak women. I don't know any. They're all strong. They're all tough guys, and they're all smarter than me. And even when I don't think that, they remind me. So I'm sitting here like,
I like this guy. I do.
He's so right. I'm about always things. Reminded, but you know, but again, I like, we both enjoy, man, I both enjoy playful and fun.
Yeah.
And we always want that in our comics. We don't want people to pick up a book, Amanda and I did, and say, oh, this wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause even in Sonya, as crazy as it is, there's a joy to it.
Oh yeah. You know? Yeah. 100%.
And I think the joy is the thing we have to go for in the mm-hmm. books. And I don't necessarily like to write things where I'm trying to preach. I think you have to stay true to the comics. And I can't read a lot of comics because they're trying to preach to me some values without and shove them onto the character. And I just feel I can smell it when it's not exactly coming from the character. You know, I wrote a book, Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters, and a guy wrote me a letter because he says, I don't like your politics in the book. And I said, well, you should blame Uncle Sam because that's his politics. And you should blame the human bomb because that's his politics. And I said, as far as my politics, I said, I hope you understand that each character has a different, you know, set of ideas and thoughts. Sure, they come from me, but I have to stay in character for each character. So it's not always stuff I agree with. I don't always write it. It's just an interesting thing how people dissect stuff. But with our comics, I always say, if we can't, Amanda and I are always trying to make each other laugh when we work together.
Yeah.
So that really was, I think, the charm of our Harley Quinn run, was you could tell two people that were making it, and then three with Chad and John Timms and everything, were always trying to up each other as far as how crazy they can get with each other and how much fun they can have. And in the quiet moments, the moments where she's reflective or she's talking about the Joker or when she confronts the Joker, you know, all the years of therapy we paid for finally pay off.
We get to use it in our books.
Yeah, we get to use it in the books.
Which is a great segue to a question we have from Monica, who couldn't be here today, which is about how does mental illness, mental health, and, you know, now I want to know your own therapy, how does that play into the writing of Harley's dialogue and the scenarios you put her in? I know you're not trying to preach something, and I got nothing but respect for that because I love a good time. But, like, how did it feed into it, I guess?
Well, you know, it really helped when Harley was being Dr. Harlene Quinzel. You know, it was really handy to have that knowledge and that experience, you know, and it was coming from a realistic place.
Yeah, I mean, I took care of my mom, you know, we took care of my mom until she passed away. And, you know, there was a lot of responsibility there. And I used to go every once in a while, her therapist would have me come in to sit with my mom because my mom had some issues that I needed to understand better. So I would sit in therapy with my mom as my mom would talk about things that happened in her life and how they affected her. And it was, you know, a frightening thing for a son to sit through. But I learned so much about her and also the respect I have for therapy. And also to understand, you know, what makes people do what they do and motivates people. And also how my mom processed a lot of stuff was very important. And the processing of things is extremely important because you have cheerleaders in your life and they tell you, you know, no matter what happens, they go, don't worry, tomorrow will be better. And that's like putting a Band-Aid on a shotgun wound, you know, at the time. It's like, okay, I understand it's coming from a nice place, but it's not really, you know, very helpful in the moment you're in. And a lot of the stuff we wrote with Harley was stuff that we would talk about. You know, things we do, and therapy helped because therapy would take things that we sat in the dark, emotions we had, problems we had that sat in the dark and shine a light right on them. You know, so much so that we'd work them out to the point where they can't be in the dark anymore. And you know, shame and all that kind of stuff does not live in the light. And a lot of the stuff we talked about and did made its way into Harley without being preachy and without being, it just, we made it, it worked its way into the book.
It was just there and it helped the story along.
Yeah. And it gave her more personality. And it also helped when we were writing her interactions with Cyborgman, who was an older, much older character. And they would talk about age and getting old and, you know, his fears and stuff like that. So a lot of that stuff works its way in there. Because of course, as writers, you learn and you try to apply. And so a lot of that, you know, was a lot of Amanda and I also talking out a lot of things, which is always great to do. Again, bringing things into the light, getting rid of the dark. That's the goal in life with any relationship, I think.
I love that. I think it's so apparent too. And I've always thought, you know, in many iterations of Harley, that one of the coolest things is the way that she can be this zany, unpredictable character who has like a kind of terrifying amount of insight into human behavior and the psyche. And so, you know, you can underestimate her easily, and then suddenly she's reading you for filth, or she's using your weaknesses against you because she understood you better. And I think that it's cool to hear that there's also a way that therapeutic, maybe skill, knowledge, even internal journey of hers was also translated into a lot of her characterization and the conversations she had. That is so cool. Thank you. It was really nice to hear about. And thank you for sharing about your mom, Jimmy. That was very special.
Yeah, no, she was my first female tough guy I ever knew.
No.
So, you know, she grew up with 10 children altogether.
I think it was nine.
Nine children. Yeah, nine children. I always count like the one. And no, you know, abandoned father, right? Left early on. My mom made it to third grade before she had to take a job in a factory. So she only had a third grade education and still managed to bring up four boys, look after my dad, all the madness, you know, and it just, she was such a tough guy. Mm-hmm. And yet, till her last day, great sense of humor.
Yeah.
Funny. Loved Amanda, of course, because how could she not? you know, and, but you, you know, these are people, you know, in your life that's what you base these characters on, the strength, because our superheroes and our characters are all based on strengths, right? And we want to read about, you know, how their process and their journey. And Amanda's great with that too. You know, she sees the characters in another way that I do. And when we both write the book, it comes together pretty well.
Mm.
You know, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to agree. I'm going to go out on a limb and say agreed. Big fan.
And Amanda's parents, tell them about your parents.
My
great,
parents are,
you know?
Yeah, my mom and dad are pretty amazing. My mother is a huge fan of like painters and illustrators. And I think her fantasy for me was I was going to grow up to either become the next Georgia O'Keeffe or Marie Cassatt or, you know, something like that. And I was like, comic books. And I think my dad was really happy about that because he wanted to be a comic book artist when he grew up. And in the 1950s, there weren't any parents out there that said, you want to be a comic book artist? Why, that's a great idea. Let's see what we can do to make that happen. That never happened. It was usually, you want to be a comic book artist? Oh my God, you're going to starve. And so his parents, of course, really discouraged him from it, which is, I think my grandfather, who was really good at math and an engineer, was just like not hearing of it. My grandmother, on his side, was a little bit like more accepting of artistic things, and she didn't discourage him quite so much. So he didn't become a comic book artist, like he wanted to work for Mad Magazine, and he went into advertising instead, which, you know, makes lots of money, but it's kind of soul sucking. But he was very happy when I decided that I wanted to be a comic book artist.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up working for Mad, right?
So. Yeah, that was like one of his proudest moments for me. He's like, you're working for Mad Magazine? That's great.
You know? Yeah, her dad is easy to buy gifts for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like those big giant coffee table Mad Magazine things. Like, and they had all these, this is a funny side. They have all these pictures of those crazy Basil Wolverton faces. And I think when he was like 13 or 14, he was obsessed with them. And he wanted to draw like Basil Wolverton. And then he did. And my Granny Nan found all of his pictures and took him to a psychiatrist or a psychologist.
Yep.
She's like, what is this? And she's like, what's wrong with you? And then like, you know, took him for analysis. Yeah. So my parents were, I was one of the few cartoonists of my generation around my age that were encouraged by their parents. There's not too many, I'm going to say, like old Gen Xers that probably, and even like young baby boomers that were encouraged by their parents to be, you know, go into cartooning and comic books. I think it's a lot more prevalent with millennials and Gen Zers. They have like really open-minded parents going, you want to do that? Well, let's see how we can help, you know, help you make that happen, which I think is pretty cool. You know, I think that's great.
The whole vibe around it has changed, right?
Yes.
Because for the longest time, people were like, comics, that's basically pornography. And then
pretty much. Now
it's very much like, oh, it's, you know, New York Times bestseller list stuff. So
they just never had real pornography. That's all I'm
Yeah, for sure.
Because if you say comics are like pornography, I'm like,
Yeah, calm down, so far, buddy.
Yeah.
Although so there is far. Some porn comics, and so God bless, far, but.
So far.
Yeah, that's a character that a lot of people, we've actually talked with Monica before about how people will just actually not really acknowledge it or something. And I think one of the things that was really special about your run is that her Jewish ancestry does come up and is a part of her life. So was that something that played a big part in how you were writing her?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had asked Paul, you know, I wish I'd talked to him more about what his intent was when, mm-hmm. you know, he made Harley the Jewish girl from Brooklyn. So I just sort of like, in my head, I'm like, Harlene Quinzel. All right, Harlene is an Irish name. Quinzel is a Jewish name. So I'm like, okay, her mom is Irish, I guess, and her dad is Jewish. But, and usually in the Jewish religion, like you take after your mom. Like if your mom is Jewish, you're Jewish. But I don't know how strict, you know, like I think the Quinzel family is not like a strict religion abiding family. Mm. They, you know, they're part
to
of,
say the least.
Yeah.
I'm like, yep.
They're definitely like the Jewish families around me when I grew up.
Right. They're not,
who would come over for Christmas morning and looking for their gifts, you know.
Right. Yeah. I grew up with a family that I was really close to, and they did the whole Hanukkah thing, and then they put up the Christmas tree, you know? So I think I feel like Harley's family is that family. So Harley will celebrate absolutely any holiday because it's a holiday, you know? It's, mm-hmm. you know, she's not going to be picky about it. It's like, what? I get time off from work and I get to like put lights up and buy gifts and eat, you know, treats. Okay. You know, so that was sort of how we approached Harley. She is a Jewish girl that will celebrate all the holidays. She doesn't care, you know, so, you know, she
celebrates every day, really.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it was also the, you know, with the gang of Harleys, right? We had, you know, we tried to create, like, if everybody wanted to be a Harley, and we had Hanukkah Harley, right? That was the, she was,
Hanukkah Quinn,
yeah.
So Hannah, she's Cy Borgman's, his brother, the one who he was always competing with, that it says in the, you know, in that story that we did, he has a brother that he was always competing with. And Hannah is that brother's granddaughter.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we, you know, the cartoon version of Cy Borgman is different than our version, because in the cartoon version, they make him like a
landlord?
A stereo. Yeah, they kind of take the stereotype that we weren't trying to do.
He's an ex-spy. He's like ex-James Bond. And, you know, he's like a cyborg ex-James Bond.
Yeah.
You know?
Even though he was like an old Coney Island Jewish guy in our comic, it's because that's what I grew up around. Mm. In the cartoon, they kind of went with the landlord kind of burning down buildings stuff. Well, I was not crazy about it. I got to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It kind of,
a lot of people have talked about that, right? And been like, that was not great.
I mean, I wish they would, you know, I wish that's a separate entity. But, you know, the Jewish, I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up with Irish, Italian, Jewish, mm-hmm. Puerto Rican, and Black. Like, that's what I grew up in. That's the mix. And we always used to say the one thing we all have in common is we like each other's food. And, you know, so there was a lot of swapping meals going on, although we did have a lot of kids dropping by on Sunday when my mom was cooking. We had a lot of different people.
Yeah, your mom would cook her ass off.
Yeah. But you know, we just kind of like it. Bruce and Paul set her in Brooklyn, and it's kind of easy for me to write Brooklyn. I lived there for 45 years. So.
Yeah, it's hard to not think of that accent, right? That very first appearance, that is, it's such a iconic animated appearance where you're just like, I can never totally hear her speaking in another voice.
Right.
So it makes sense that the Jewish culture, of course, that's there. That's part of who she is.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I'm glad you think so too. We've talked a lot on this podcast about it before, where we've been kind of like, we love it when people, at least at least acknowledge it and kind of run with it a little bit, because sometimes it seems to kind of vanish from the books a little bit.
Our Christmas special, we covered it pretty well, I thought, too, which is pretty funny. You know, the whole issue. One of the stories in there was based on a true story, too. So it was kind of funny.
Yes,
yes. We get into that in another podcast.
Yeah, well, we'll have to have you back.
Yes, the next podcast could be about how the stuff that happened in our real lives made it into all the Harley books.
Yes.
Yeah, everything we've gotten so far, I've loved. So we're ready for chapter two anytime.
There you go.
So we are big fans of yours, obviously, and we want to keep up on everything that's going on. Invincible Red Sonja, I believe, just now is getting collected as a trade paperback, and I am certainly picking that up. But what do you have that's coming down the pike? Like, are you working on any big projects that you can currently talk about? Because I know a lot of people are like, yeah, I'm excited about this one thing that I cannot say anything about because otherwise my agent will put a hit out on me or whatever.
We're doing, I'm trying, my hand at illustrating. Jimmy and I are writing this together, but I'm illustrating a vertical comic, and it is proving to be more challenging than I thought it would be. It's like going to art school all over again, because it's so much different than, you know, comic books, you know, the layout and the pacing and everything. So it's for a thing called Zest World. And Jimmy's already got his...
Yeah, if you go to zestworld.com, you'll see the Amanda Conner, Jimmy Palmiotti page, and you can subscribe. It's a mailer, so you get it in your mailbox every week. And there's comics, and it has different levels. It could be free, it could be a pay level. But we're working on two books, and the one that's already like 20 pages in is a book called Found, which is a story I'm doing with Juan Santa Cruz about a family that is sort of like working for Smithsonian or filming a volcano in the Pacific in the international waters, and the volcano erupts and spits out a spaceship, and it's about what happens.
Okay.
After that. Okay, and then Amanda's story. Go ahead, you can talk about that.
It's called Boom Pow. And it is, it takes place in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it is a young lady who owns a donut shop, because that was one of our favorite things when we went to New Mexico, was the donut shops. You know? So she has a special but kind of useless superpower that she really doesn't know what to do with it. And it's a little bit of a pain in the ass. And on one of her treks into the desert to look for the rare desert truffle that is the ingredient of her most popular donut, she stumbles upon an immortal.
And what's her name?
The girl who owns the donut shop is K-Boom, and the immortal is Booty Pow Pow. So,
Booty Pow Pow! Well, I will be reading both of those. They sound incredible.
Well, it's not up yet, because I'm still, like, you know, working on it. But it will be up soon.
I'll be
waiting with bated breath.
Yes, Booty Pow Pow. And so that's at zestworld.com. And then we have a short story coming from probably in the fall for DC Comics that has something to do with what we were talking about today. And then we can't really mention it. And then we have a teaser you'll see solicited in the end of June.
One of those other things we can't talk about.
You can't talk about. Yeah. But we're doing it for Image Comics. And it is like a part two of something we did many years ago. But I can't say what it is. But you can put on your Columbo jacket and go find out. And then go out in the rain.
I'm sure.
And then go stand in the rain for an hour. So that's what we got going on. I mean, we're doing a Kickstarter in a couple of weeks. That's going to be the first Amanda Conner sketchbook.
Yes.
And what's the theme of the sketchbook, Amanda?
Sort of like sexy, naughty, and sort of filthy things that I've done in my life. Or I've drawn in my life, I should say.
Yeah, I was going to say. That's the special. If we hit $1 million in Kickstarter, we're gonna offer the video of the other thing she mentioned. So so we'll see. Well,
that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I mean, Amanda, Jimmy, you've been incredible. Before we go, I know you gave us some links there. So listeners, if you didn't hear those, they will be in the show notes. Do you all want to plug anywhere folks can find you online elsewhere? Maybe social media?
Oh, I am a terrible, terrible, terrible social media person. I have a Twitter handle and I have an Instagram account. And I just miserably ignore them so much. You know, I really need to pay better attention to them.
Her Twitter thinks she posts Wordle things on
it. Yeah, that's about it. And it is the most ironic Twitter handle that anybody has ever had. It's called Amanda Rants-a-Lot. Which is pretty much the opposite of what I do. my Instagram is Amanda Connor Art.
Yeah, and mine is Jay Palmiotti on Twitter, and I actually am on it a lot. And Instagram is same thing under our name. But we do have a website called paperfilms.com. And if you go on the website and you just click on a subscribe, you get once a month, you'll get pretty much what we're doing, what shows we're going to be at, and a lot of Amanda's art. Whatever she's working on, you'll see a bunch of that, like some pencil roughs and stuff like that. But we also we just want to make sure people know where we're going. If we're going to go around the hometown, we want them to come out and say hi. So we definitely list all our shows. And I think our next couple are like Washington, D.C., right? And then San Diego Comic Con are the initial ones right away out of the gate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, are those the next two, Washington, then San Diego?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because we finished MegaCon and we managed to get out of there without COVID, unlike most of our friends. So, you know.
So far, so good.
So far. We'll tell you Thursday when we check again.
We tested last night and today, and then we're going to test again in a couple of days just to see, you know.
I'm sending you non-COVID vibes.
Thank you.
I hope you're in the clear. I hope you're in the clear.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Listeners, if you missed any of that, don't worry. You can go click on our show notes and we'll have links to places you can find more about Amanda and Jimmy. Amanda and Jimmy, oh my God. This was like, I laughed so hard. I cried at least twice. I learned so much. I love the inside scoop that we got on the timeline. I'm going to be thinking about that when I try to fall asleep tonight. I am just having the best time. This was great. We will have to have you back. It sounds like there's many more stories to tell.
Absolutely.
And we will look forward to that. Sarah, you're the best. Thank you as always. Monica, we missed you today, but thank you for your great questions. They helped lead the conversation in fun directions. Kate, our sound editor, we are so lucky to have you and we love you. Listeners, patrons, followers, thank you for being with us. And thanks for another great episode of Bitches on Comics.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thanks so much, you guys.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @BitchesOnComics and on Instagram at @BitchesOnComics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com. and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm S.E. Fleenor. You can learn more about me at sefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the
the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.